So let's reflect for a moment that we're able to be here today due to the kindness of others, the kindness of our parents who gave us this body, to the kindness of everybody who brought us up and taught us when we were young, to the kindness of people who built the roads and built the car and built the hall and everything that we're using in order to gather together today. So really be aware of how we are interdependent with other living beings. We aren't isolated units. And for that reason, let's include others in the motivation for our spiritual practice. Wanting to better ourselves and progress on the path to full awakening so that we can contribute to the welfare of others more effectively, without any hesitation, and with great wisdom and compassion. So let's have that be our motivation for being here today. Sunday series of talks that we've been doing have been based on this book, Don't Believe Everything You Think, which is a commentary on a Tibetan poem called The 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas being people who have generated great love, great compassion, and a very strong altruistic intention, and want to progress along the spiritual stages to full awakening so that they can contribute to the welfare of others more effectively. So we've been going through it verse by verse, and this is one of my favorite texts. It's quite challenging. Many of you have been here for previous Sundays, and you see that he often presents difficult situations or even favorable situations and then tells us a spiritual way to consider and think about these situations instead of our normal way. And often the spiritual way is the total opposite of our normal reaction. Yeah, so it really puts us like, oh, wow, you know. So the verse we're on now is going to do that too. I'll give you a forewarning. Okay. So the particular, we're on verse 19. Okay. So the verse reads, though you become famous and many bow to you, and you gain riches equal to Vaishravanas. Vaishravana is in Buddhist cosmology, a king who has incredible kind of wealth. Okay, so you gain riches in excess of Bill Gates. Okay, so though you become famous and many bow to you, you're famous, you're wealthy, people really respect you. They admire you, maybe they envy you a little bit, and you have riches, you know, more than Bill Gates, you know, five times over. Okay, so picture that for a moment. If you're in that situation, how are you going to feel? Just, I mean, what's your usual reaction? How are you going to feel? Like, yeah, I'm on top of the world. Yeah.
Indestructible.
Yeah, very indestructible. I have all this wealth, I have all this fame and power. Everybody knows my name. Everybody's admired me. Everybody knows I'm so successful. All I have to do is snap my fingers, you know, and because I am so well known and so rich, people will go along with any plan or idea I have and do what I want. Yeah? So a bit self-inflated. Yeah, a little bit, you think? Yeah, do you think you'd get self-inflated if you were really wealthy? Or if you were really powerful, really famous? Yeah, you're a movie star, basketball star.
You could say, like, if you, before you got there, you might have more altruistic motives, having experienced both, but I wonder after you're there, after a period of time, I wonder what would change.
Yeah, yeah, after you've had that, when you first get it, it's like, whoa. Yeah, but after a while, yeah, things might change. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or you get habituated to it and it's expected. And so there's nothing is enough because you have one plane, you want three.
Yeah, yeah. So that could also happen. Yeah, that it's habituated, it's expected, and the same dissatisfaction that you had before comes with you, and you're able to satisfy that. You're able to get your three planes, you know, and you're able to get whatever it is that you're wanting. And everybody admires you. Yeah. So finally, all your siblings that you know, competed with, they all now think you're wonderful. Your parents, who used to tell you you would amount to nothing, are now, like, so proud of you. Okay. So that's how most of us would react, right? We'd feel pretty good. Okay, listen to what he's telling us to do. Okay, this is, again, from a spiritual perspective. He says, see that worldly fortune is without essence and be unconceited. He's got to be kidding. Come on. Who in their right mind would see worldly fortune as without essence? Come on. It has so much essence. You can move people. You can do things. You can be somebody. How can he say it's without essence? And why is he saying be unconceited? When you've worked so hard and you've achieved this, why not be a little bit proud of yourself? What do you think?
Because it can be taken away just as quickly.
You're not supposed to say that. Because most of the time, when that happens, we think it's here, it's ours, and, like she said, indestructible. Nothing can take it away from us. Yeah. Most people have that wrong notion. You know, what you said is completely correct. But most people shove that away and think it's here to stay. Hallelujah. Okay. But it's really true. It can go just as quickly. Yeah. And it often does. You know, you think of the stock market crash in 28, you think of the recession that happened. You know, those are quite gross examples of people's wealth disappearing. But also people's power disappears. Who was it? No. Papa Doc and Baby Doc, you know, Duvalier? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the dictator of Haiti for many years, you know, who was rich and famous and could wind anybody around his finger if he tried hard enough so he could get his way. And now he's dead. And what did he take with him? Yeah? The wealth didn't go with him. He's still famous after he died, but he's not here to enjoy the fame. You know, from a Buddhist viewpoint, he's going to get reborn in another realm, according to the karma that he created. I don't, from what I've read about him, I don't think he's created a lot of virtuous karma. He seemed rather ruthless and caused a lot of suffering in the world. So it doesn't look, you know, good for having a good rebirth. Even if he did have a good rebirth, he's still not here to enjoy the fame. And the fame is actually, he's well known, but not everybody likes him. Yeah? Yeah, I was even thinking, you know, when Margaret Thatcher died, because she was very famous, how these people started playing, you know, The Wicked Witch is Dead. Do you remember that? I mean, that was really kind of over the top, kind of rude to say that. But, you know, there she is. She's still famous. Yeah, not here to enjoy it for the people who loved her, and not here to hear people say awful things about her either. Yeah. So at the time of death, none of that stuff goes with. And yet at the time during our life, we think that wealth and fame and admiration and so on, they are indicators or markers of having a successful life, of having made it, of being somebody, of being able to command respect. So it's strange, isn't it, you know, that you can spend your whole life building something up that seems to work while you're alive, and then in the matter of one breath, it all disappears at the time of death. And for many people, it disappears even before that, when there's a big shift in the economy, a big shift in the political situation. Yeah. We can make so many examples, can't we? Yeah. I mean, I think of JFK. Yeah. Remember when JFK was president? I know for some of you this was... Yeah. But some of us remember JFK, don't we? Yeah.
It's an airport, isn't it?
You know, and it's like, well, not everybody, I mean, because some people like Nixon, but but they learned their lesson afterward. Yeah, but JFK was so glamorous, you know, remember that? And the Kennedy family, you know, he had wealth and lineage and, you know, everything like that. Jackie Kennedy with, you know, I mean, they were just, everybody was so impressed. And then afterwards, look at what came out about him. Yeah? And look at what came out about, you know, the Kennedy family too. It was really kind of amazing. And so you can have, you know, status and then it just disappears like that. Yeah. So it really is without essence in the sense that, you know, come, come, go, go very quickly. And even if you have it, does it really mean you're successful? Does it really mean you're a good person? Yeah. I mean, if we stop and think about that, somebody who has all those signs of success, does it really mean that they're a good human being? Or do we sometimes get a little bit suspicious of people who are quite wealthy, wondering how they made their wealth? Yeah. I mean, like, would you want to be part of the Madoff family right now? Yeah? I mean, look, He was the one who did, I don't know what a Ponzi scheme is, but he did one or two or however many. Anyway, he really cheated a lot of people. He was an investment banker.
His son just committed suicide recently.
Pardon?
His son just committed suicide.
Yeah, yeah. One son died, I think, and another one committed suicide. Yeah? So, you know, you have all of that, but then gone very quickly in so much tragedy. So it is with that essence. But I really wonder, you know, why do we even consider those kinds of things marks of success to start with? Yeah, why are we so easily impressed by these kind of external things about other people? Yeah. I was reading an article this week in the New York Times about some psychologists or sociologists who did some studies, and they found that especially in the States nowadays, people do not cross over class lines very much, you know, that people really stay within their own class. So in the land where everybody's supposed to be equal, you know, people are actually quite class conscious and stay within their own group. You know, they don't feel really comfortable if you're high class, you know, having friends who are lower class, or if you're lower class, having friends who are higher class. People don't feel comfortable with that. They feel like they're out of, water, like a fish out of water. Okay? And so, then the wealthy get this, and powerful, in quotes, get this certain kind of regard. But why do we think that that is indicative of success? And why do we think that it's indicative of happiness? You know, it's true if you have wealth, maybe you don't have as much physical suffering, but you might have really tremendous mental suffering.
Well, if you're physically wealthy, you get good education. As in some of the poor, they get poor education and they can never get to the next
level. Yeah, yeah. Education is a big thing about the ability to change classes. Yeah. And this article was also saying that because people don't cross that boundary so often, there's no way for people of lower caste to class. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's almost caste. To make the connections with people of higher classes that they need in order to advance, you know. But, you know, I just ask myself, what, you know, human beings have markers for, you know, indicators how we assess if somebody is successful or happy. And, you know, how do we choose the ones we choose?
Well, I would say that we don't really choose. I would say that it's kind of culturally ingrained. And, I mean, the whole, like, enterprise of civilization, you know, what differentiates us from, like, tribes is that it started off with these people who sought to be rulers, who had, like, material and could, like, get people to fight for it. And so, like, the whole enterprise of civilization, it just, like, builds up the ego of the ruling class, and it teaches people to want that, but it makes it harder for them to get that, so they just want it more.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's definitely a thing of conditioning, isn't it? You know, conditioning and values that are passed on generation to generation. Yeah.
Well, you know, when we were meditating, and they were talking about the five senses,
mm-hmm.
and what is most appealing to us compared to what we don't like. And if you think about it, that everything that is most appealing to our five senses are usually the most softest as far as touch, and the most beautiful things as far as sight and hearing beautiful music. And all of that usually comes with the wealth,
mm-hmm.
and with you have more availability to those items.
Yeah. Yeah, so you have more, It gives you less physical suffering and more physical pleasure. Okay. But why do we think that makes somebody successful? Yeah? This is a question, you know. I think it's really good to think about. Why does that mean? You know, I mean, do you know people who have all that who are unhappy? Look at American culture in general. We're one of the richest countries. Are Americans happy people? By and large, are they happy people? When you look at the way the country is running, does it strike you as a happy country?
Sometimes I think it's generated, you know, especially with our television and with the internet, you know, if you get into one group, there will be a lot of alarm to catch your attention, you know, and what do we want to do? We want to protect ourselves from hurt and from injury. So even the old story, the sky is falling, it's still being used a lot to help us pay attention. You know, if we go with the marijuana culture and say, hey, it's okay, we're just going to sit here and be harmonious, that doesn't move our nation forward. So you have to have a certain amount of alarm and irritation to...
And fear. Fear. Yeah.
Well, I think you referred to something that, about that it seems to me is that we think of ourselves as a nation of equals, so that when we see the wealth, what appears to be a success, I think many Americans feel as if they ought to also be there. Mm-hmm. And yet, in fact, there are class barriers, there are educational barriers. So mm-hmm. I think whatever suffering we have as far as economically, it's exacerbated by the feeling that it's a personal failure. Mm-hmm. That somehow, that's not how it's supposed to work.
Yeah. You know, yeah, very much.
Mm-hmm. There's a concept called relative deprivation, and I think that's really true. I teach this in my class as well, that people tend to be happier if they're doing better than those around them. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter. So if everyone around you is making $30,000 a year and you're making 50, you feel better about yourself. But if everyone's making $500,000 a year and you're making 300, then mm-hmm. you feel bad about yourself. So it was this whole idea of it's not really how much you have, it's how much you have in comparison to
everybody else.
You.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So isn't that interesting too? I mean, how much happiness is looked at as something exterior to us, yeah, as, you know, as manifest by how much we have in relationship to other people.
Like it or not, if you're financially secure, you don't have to worry where your next meal is, or you're making your rent, or whatever.
Right. But who in this room feels financially secure? Do any of you feel financially secure?
I'm living at home with my two parents right now and not paying any expenses. This year I'm doing well. Ask me in 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's interesting, you know? Do we ever have financial security? Or whatever we get, you know, underneath there's this feeling of it could go at any minute, so it would actually be better if I had more. Yeah, in case this disappears,
then I have some more. You're right, because any day the stock market could drop at the moment, and that's where all my wealth is.
Yeah.
So I do know it could leave, but I don't want more. Maybe that's just me.
Okay. Okay, you're an exception. Good for you. Yeah, the rest of us don't feel financially secure. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know many people who do, even no matter how much money they have. Yeah.
I say Bill Gates has to
feel. Excuse me, somebody else would like to speak.
I just wanted to say what came to my mind is the tremendous amount of self-medication we do. Mm-hmm. In our country, like we have mm-hmm. an amazing amount of prescription SSRIs for depression and anxiety, and then we have a lot of people, not just the traditional drug addict persona, but we have a lot of really wealthy people and people all across the spectrum addicted opiates, because they're looking to relieve their pain and they suffer a
spiritual pain.
And it's that's not happiness.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter like what you have materially. Like there's something deeper that people are really hurting in. And there's a path that they're not. I don't know. Everybody's at a different level. And people would love like that. That's so simple. The Buddhist thing that I'm learning is like everybody wants freedom from suffering. And they want happiness, and that's what they're aiming at.
Yeah, and that's bottom line, was propelling everybody to do everything they do. And yet, when we're looking outside for happiness, it becomes totally elusive. Yeah, because we can never get everything we want. Yeah, and even if we get what we want, we can't hold on to it. Or, after a while, as somebody was saying, yeah, I think it was you, it loses its fascination and no longer seems to be what we thought it was going to be. Okay? And so I think this is all pointing to the fact that, you know, happiness, okay, you know, some degree of material wealth can prevent, you know, physical suffering. But at a certain point, that ceases to work, and that, you know, what we're really wanting inside is some kind of peace and happiness that goes beyond what money can give us, beyond what fame can give us, beyond what popularity can give us. Yeah, we're looking for something else, but we don't know where to find it. So we keep looking outside of ourselves, and that's why we have all these people addicted to opiates, you know, or trying this drug or that drug. Each generation has their own set of drugs, you know, and we look to them for our, to give us something that we were lacking without them, yeah. And yet that doesn't work either. So I think what it's indicating at the end of the day is that real happiness isn't something that is found externally. It's something that comes from inside of us. Yeah? And so that's why he's saying, see that worldly fortune is without essence and be unconceited. In other words, don't get attached to all this external stuff that isn't really going to cut it at the end of the day for you. Yeah? But look inside and try and understand that by changing, you know, if we change our mind, if we change our perspective, if we change our views and opinions and ideas and interpretations, yeah, that then our whole experience of the world will change. And so that change is something that each of us has to do individually. We can't hire somebody else to do it for us. Yeah. I tend to lose my temper. Please, can I hire you to meditate to make me calm? Yeah. That isn't going to work. Yeah. There's certain things that we have to do ourselves. And on that level, we really are genuinely equal because nobody else can do it for us. Yeah. But this own internal change is something that we do ourselves. But also it gives us, you know, in one way it's like, oh, you mean I can't kind of hire somebody to do it? It's kind of a letdown or, you know. I can't be lazy and hire somebody. But on the other hand, it's like, well, that gives us individual power, doesn't it? If we're the only ones who can change our mind, yeah, then that means that we have that possibility to do that. Yeah, and it empowers us to go about doing that. Because nobody else can change our thoughts for us. Yeah, people can influence us. They can guide us. Okay, but we're the ones who have to work on ourselves to change the way that we're thinking. In each of the verses in the book, there's a story that kind of illustrates the idea of the verse. And these stories are all true stories that people told when we were, you know, either they wrote to me or when we were sitting around the kitchen table, people tell me stories. So I thought I'd read one. It's, okay, the story's called We're Successful, So What? It's by one of the Abbey nuns, but I won't tell you which one. Okay, so a number of years ago, I joined a Japanese drum group. Not having a drumming teacher, we were all self-taught, but since some of the drummers were Japanese, we thought that made us authentic. We wore these strange, exotic-looking outfits, and our drums weren't real drums. They were made out of sewer pipes covered with rawhide. After 9 months of rehearsal, we made our debut performance at the Heritage Festival, an international gathering of ethnic communities in Canada. Over the three-day weekend, we performed 9 times, drumming and making wild and vigorous movements. Astonishingly, the crowd loved us, and we retreated like rock stars from day one. Actually, we were really bad and were hopeless as drummers. But since no one knew anything about Japanese drumming, we looked impressive. Right away, we had a cult following. We would wear our Tika no Taiko shirts. That means northernmost drumming group in Japanese. And in the streets, people would stop us and say, "You are so fantastic. I love your drumming." Needless to say, we lapped it up. This went on for a year, and our fame and admiration kept on increasing. For a New Year's program called the First Night Festival, they gave us the best venue in the city because we were famous in that city. The place was packed 2 hours before the show even began. You'd think it was the Rolling Stones, the way we were greeted when we came on stage. People rose to their feet, cheering and clapping. Everyone in the group, including me, thought, "Yep, we're on the top of the heap here." But through all that insanity, and while that huge uproar was going on, I began to think, "What's wrong here? I'm not happy. All this fame and adulation are not making me happy. What we're doing is fraudulent." I was conflicted inside because although we were making people happy, I still felt an ache inside. I thought something was wrong with me until I heard Dharma teachings, and then understanding dawned. Good example, huh? Good example. So, it really centers on this thing of we may have a lot of external stuff. The unhappiness is still there. So there's nothing to be conceited about. Yeah, we should see it as like sand falling through our fingers, yeah, water falling through our fingers. Nothing that's really there that is substantial, that is of true value in the long run. Okay? But when we can change our mind, yeah, then no matter where we are, whether people clap and cheer us or boo and hiss at us, inside our own mind, we can remain peaceful and calm and even joyful. So there's a big lesson there to be learned. And we do encounter people or read about people who have had incredible hardship in their life, and yet they're very happy people. Hmm? Yeah, if you think of Nelson Mandela, yeah, when I think of him, he had incredible hardship, and yet no bitterness, or His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Mm. Yeah? And you really see people being really happy, although, not having much in terms of worldly wealth. My teachers are mostly Tibetans and the elder generation of Tibetans. And so they were all people who escaped in 1959 when the Chinese communists took over Tibet. And they all came out with no more than their teacup. Every Tibetan carries their teacup with them. And you put it in your shirt. And they really literally came out with not much more than that and went into refugee camps, which were the old British POW camps in India. Yeah, and they were there for many years, and until gradually they were able to start establishing their own monasteries and so on. Yeah, but when you meet these people, you'd never know kind of what they went through in their life, because they're basically happy people. Yeah, at least my teachers are, because they really practice the teachings, and. Yeah. So something works there. Okay. So, time for questions or comments?
Mm-hmm. I think when we talk about people who are rich and famous, we have to remember all of those that recognize their talent and encourage them to move forward and hope for great things. And I recall Andrew Carnegie, for instance. Mm-hmm. He was rich and powerful as a leader in the transportation industry of our country. However, he did at least one good thing. He established the Carnegie Libraries. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the people around him that motivated him to do that were, they impacted him greatly to do good. And so I think no one is completely evil or completely good. Mm-hmm. That each one of us has a mix of perfections and imperfections.
Yeah.
And we need to honor that in those that we think of as rich and famous. Mm-hmm. They did good things.
Yeah. Okay, so that nobody is all good or all bad. And so rather than be jealous of people who are rich or famous or knock them down simply because we're jealous or we love to pick on people who are prominent, to remember that they also do good deeds and they help others. And also to remember that whatever talents anybody has, including ourselves, these came due to people who influenced us, our teachers, yeah, maybe family members, maybe friends. We aren't independent people, but what we know or our ability to be successful even in a worldly way comes about due to other people teaching and encouraging us. Yeah. And interestingly, due to the people who value what we happen to have. Yeah. If other people did not value money, then there would be no status in having money. Yeah? if other people did not value having enough horses and elephants to trample somebody else, then those people would not be considered powerful. Yeah, that to think of the fact that social status is not something that somebody has in and of themselves because they got something, but because other people confer that status on them. So actually, the person with higher status is very dependent on everybody else. Yeah, if you think about it, it's true, isn't it? Yeah. Or somebody who is popular. Remember when you were in high school and you wanted to be popular? Now we don't want to be popular. We call it some other word. But we still want to be popular. But we have to distinguish ourselves from high school kids. Although our gray hair does that very well already. Yeah, but, you know. So where was I going with that? Oh, yes. Yeah, so being popular is not something that somebody is in and of themselves because they're a nice person or because they have something special in them. Somebody becomes popular in dependence on the other people around them who say, that's a popular person.
You know, very well thinking, the example that came to my mind was the recent football scandals where we had people who were highly paid athletes and we had to then say, okay, now we know something about their personal life. Is that important enough to take away the money and fame? Or should we let it go because after all their money, they have money and they're famous. It seems like we really had that class.
Yeah, this is very good. Like, what criteria are we going to use to consider people on top of the pile and high status in society? Is it just being a good football player and having money and good looks? Or, but what about your personal life? Yeah. And but then what about the people whose personal lives have really good ethical conduct, but they don't have money and good looks and they don't play football? Yeah. Then how does society view those people? And, you know, it's very interesting, but what we see here is that any status somebody has is not something received by themselves or through their own effort. It's received in dependence upon other people. Yeah. So actually, when you have that status, you're beholden to other people. You should actually be kinder to other people because they're the ones giving you that status. And yet studies show that people who have a lot of wealth and power generally have a harder time feeling empathy for others. Yeah. Actually, if they understood better, they would have more understanding for others. Yeah.
So to personalize all of this and to culminate it in myself, all that's been described is basically comes down to an identity crisis. And it's whether it's recognized as such. Am I having an identity crisis based on what I'm allowing in or whatever? That's what it comes down to. A recognized identity crisis can lead me into the resolve of what has been expressed.
Right, right. This is very interesting too, because you're pointing out how we as individuals create an identity based on how others view us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we think we are what they think we are. Even though we're trying to create an image of who we think we are so that they will believe that we are that person we think we are. Yeah? And if they affirm who I think I am, then they're good people. If they don't affirm who I think I am, I don't like them. If they think I have more capacity and more talent than I think I have, then I think they're stupid. Because they don't really know how totally, you know, incapable I am. But if I think I have more capacity and talent than I think I have, then I need to correct their opinion of me. Because they shouldn't have that idea. It's wrong.
Make a good television series.
But it's very interesting, isn't it? This whole process of constructing an identity and then believing that that's who we are, and how we get upset if people underestimate or overestimate our abilities.
But what's wonderful about it is it always leads, eventually, it'll always lead to some kind of awareness. Because eventually, you'll be unhappy. Eventually.
Yeah. You know, the whole thing, at some point, you can't hold it together. Most people can go through their, many people go through their whole life, you know. They may be unhappy, but they won't acknowledge it. Yeah. Because if you acknowledge that you're unhappy, then your status goes down. Yeah. So you have to pretend to be happy even when you're not, so that you can make other people think you're happy people, so that you can think you're a happy person.
Well, to a certain degree, though, I mean, a lot of outside influences make it so you don't really have an option. Either the stock market or personal loss, or everything just kind of unravels and falls apart. And regardless, you're stuck there realizing for the first time that, oh, it didn't really matter. So, and having, and forcing awareness or forcing consciousness for the first time.
Yeah. And it really does bring an identity crisis if I wasn't that person that I constructed myself to be.
Exactly.
Who am I then?
Yeah, exactly. Who am I? Who am I? And I was reading also about how, about Facebook, you know, and how people, you post things on your Facebook page to create an image of yourself as this happy person, successful person, da 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 da. And yet inside you don't feel so good. Then you look at your friends' Facebook pages, and of course they all look so happy, so together, so wonderful, not like me. Yeah. Even though what they're posting on their Facebook pages is a created personality that they're wanting the world to believe too. Yeah. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah. And then we feel, oh, I'm the only unhappy one. All my friends are happy, but then they also feel the same way because our Facebook page makes us look like we're happy. Yeah. So that's why I have a Facebook page, but I don't even, she runs it. So everything you think I am, it's her.
Mom on the Facebook page. My son actually put a post up that he'd run in the Spartan race. So I commented below, well, I hope you bought donuts for everybody that lost, because if they hadn't raced with you, you would have been running around by yourself. So I said, you've got to thank them.
Yeah.
Donuts.
Right.
So everybody needs a mom on Facebook. It brings them donuts. Yeah.
Yeah. I know, my nephew plays football in high school, and his team had 30 straight wins, and the last win, you know, the local paper had a picture of him, you know, in the sports section, you know, with his name and everything. And then, of course, the next week they lost the game, you know. So I wrote him, and I said, you know, I said, this is going to sound really weird to you, but sometimes when things don't work out for me, I say to myself, oh, that's very good. It makes me more humble. Yeah. and that never hurts me. Yeah, he did answer my email. My email. I was surprised. I thought he may never speak to me. Yeah.
What did he say?
Thank you. Okay.
What did he say?
He said, yeah, it was disappointing, but we'll be back for the next game. Probably what his coach told them. But I'm hoping, you know, that it just gets planted in the mind. I said also, you know, you can think of that the other team was really happy and rejoice that somebody else was happy. Yeah, I'm sure he's never heard that before from his coach. Okay. So, let's dedicate now. There's some verses on page 30 in the blue book. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.